Welcome to the Should've Bet More podcast presented by Gold Boys. Coming up on the show, Ben Wilson of ESPN Plus, VSiN, Fox. He covers every sport. We will talk a little bit of everything with Ben. NBA Finals thoughts, maybe get some College World Series, baseball. I know Ben is good with all these sports, so we'll kind of go around the globe with Ben. But I'll get to the finals here in a minute, but kind of have to put the finishing touches on the story. I spent a lot of time on the past couple shows. Very strange, this whole Hurley Lakers thing where out of nowhere, I mean, let's just summarize what happened. Lakers season ends in April. UConn season ends in April. And all of a sudden, out of June 5th, out of nowhere, Hurley is interested in the Lakers. We get this scoop from Adrian Wojnarowski. Scoop, you can probably put quotations around it. And look, it was a scoop at the time, but it's a big story. Lakers and Hurley, there's interest. It might happen. It might happen soon. And then a couple days later, Woj gets another scoop. Hurley's not going to Lakers to turn them down. So very strange. Seemed like somebody used somebody for leverage. I mean, you get the idea here. Just reading the tea leaves, and Ethan Strauss, who has a Substack, used to work for ESPN, used to work with Woj. He's been pretty much on this that, hey, Woj does not like to get out scooped. And Shams had this story that Redick was going to be the Lakers coach. And Shams is obviously Woj's rival reporter in terms of the NBA scoops. And Shams had the Redick to the Lakers scoop, and then Woj didn't like that, especially because Redick's a coworker of Woj's. So there's a lot of different angles to this where Woj wanted to blow Shams out of the water and just come up with a story here that would make that story invalid. And this served a few purposes, I guess. And that is, first of all, Woj comes up with two scoops. Again, Hurley interested in the Lakers, Hurley turns down the Lakers. So you could say he got two scoops, but nothing really happened. So he really didn't get any scoops, but it's perceived that Woj is on top of it. He's got this Hurley story, and he gets his buddy Hurley, who he's close with. He wrote a book about his dad. Woj did. He gets his buddy Hurley more money. Sounds like a nice little raise from UConn, and it makes the Shams Redick story look invalid. So seem like there's a lot behind the scenes here. Who knows if it was ever going to happen? But just very strange how, again, these teams haven't played in so long. UConn hasn't played since April. Lakers haven't played since April. Why June 5th all of a sudden, hey, Hurley out of nowhere is going to be the coach. And then a few days later, oh, not going to happen. Supposedly it was a $100 million deal. Now it was only 70, and the Lakers are moving on. So more than meets the eye, I would say. I think that's fair, where we would have heard about this sooner, and it wouldn't have fallen through so quickly. So I'm not sure how serious this ever was. I think we all kind of got duped by this, and you know, we all got some news out of it. We all got some content out of it. But at the end of the day, I mean, Woj breaks two big stories. But, you know, if nothing really happened, what stories are there to break? So very odd. UConn stays. Hurley stays at UConn. And Hurley's going to, you know, be even more popular now because not only did he win two championships, but you get the sense that UConn where, oh, man, we're almost going to lose him. There's this 3 or 4 days where it feels like he's gone. Then he comes back. He almost adds another layer to his popularity. At UConn, and you know, who knows if he takes an NBA job down the road, but just a very strange 3 or 4 days. And it seems like there was some leverage at play here and some back scratching to get Shams Redick story out of the news and to get Hurley in the mix here. And again, I don't know how serious this ever was. Very odd sequence, but Hurley stays. And again, Hurley wasn't going to help the Lakers as much as he was going to hurt UConn. He barely moves the needle for the Lakers, and whatever, $70 million, that's a lot of money, but that's in California with taxes to leave a chance for the three-peat. That's not an offer you can't refuse. The whole idea here was, hey, Lakers are going to make him an offer he can't refuse. That offer they gave him was nice. It was a lot of money. I would like to make that much money, but that was not an offer that couldn't be refused. That was an easily refusable, not easily, but that was certainly a refusable offer. He was making less than Monty Williams. He was going to be like the 11th highest paid NBA coach. That was not, hey, I can't possibly turn this down, which was the whole thing. We were told that Lakers were going to offer Hurley some amount of money that could not possibly be turned down. Like talking 8 years, $120 million, that would have been a hard deal to turn down. 8 years, $120 million. How do you say no to that? Well, 6 for 70, you get a little raise from UConn. It's not that much of a difference. You can say no to it where, hey, I got a chance to three-peat at UConn. I'm probably not a contender with the Lakers. You know, Lakers have been a playing team the last few years. So much to do about nothing. Hurley stays. Quickly, the finals. Celtics up 2-0. I've done a couple pods about it. Recent reactions, you know, live reactions following the games. I don't see a path for Dallas to get back in the series. Maybe they can get game three, and then who knows? Put a little pressure on Celtics for game four. But it feels like Boston gets one of these in Dallas, if not both of them. It just feels like there's too many guys on Boston that can defend and shoot three-pointers, and they kind of lulled us to sleep with these half-hearted performances against Indiana. They look bad against the Cavs, but they won a lot of these games, and they're really good. They got a bunch of guys that can shoot threes. They got a bunch of guys that can play defense. Jrue Holiday had a funny line. He said, even our white guys can defend, which is, I thought, a funny line. And Holiday's got a good chance, plus 750 to win MVP. I think that's a good bet. Media likes him. He's kind of, you can play the narrative angle that he's the missing piece. You know, he won a championship with the Bucks. The Celtics came up short all the years. Then they get Holiday. You can make, certainly from a narrative case, that Holiday is the MVP. And usually the MVP goes to the best player, but Tatum hasn't played well. So they just gave Brown the Eastern Conference MVP. If this is a short series, I think Holiday's very alive. And I have a feeling Boston wins game three and sweeps. I just do. I haven't had a great feel for the series. I like Boston the series. I thought it'd be a longer series. That does not seem it's going to be the case. Again, who knows? We've seen these series where they switch venues and then they can change the momentum, where all it takes is one win. Luka goes off, Kyrie gets going, and hey, it's 2-1, and then you're home for game four with a chance to tie it. Kind of hoping that's the case, just because it's been such a bad playoffs. I'd like to see a little drama, a little intrigue, but I got a feeling Boston gets one, if not both, of these games in Dallas. Boston is plus 260 to sweep. I don't think that's a terrible bet, because if you win game three, if you're Boston, they're going to flip this line to where the team down 0-3 never gets any respect. Boston's going to be like a 4.5 point favorite in game four. So you set yourself up with a nice little number. You basically just have to win game three, and then you can, profit off it. You can set up a middle. I think they get both of them here. I 50-50 whether Boston gets one or two. I don't think Dallas gets both. I'd be shocked if we're headed back to Boston 2-2, just the way the series has gone and the way Boston is completely dominated. Just there's not enough shooting on Dallas. There's not enough talent. They're starting to look like they were a 5 seed for a reason. They're just outside of Luka, who's kind of hobbled, and Kyrie hasn't done anything. Well, there's not a lot else. The next 6-7 guys in terms of the best players are all on Boston, which was why I liked Boston in the beginning. I just thought Boston hasn't been impressive. Maybe Dallas can force a game 7. So we'll talk more about that series next with Ben Wilson. We'll do some College World Series. We'll bounce around. That is next. This is Should Have Bet More podcast. All right, we are back. Should Have Bet More podcast. You can catch him pretty much everywhere. ESPN Plus, I guess Fox, VSiN. There's nowhere this man doesn't give his excellent play-by-play. First time joining us, it is the great Ben Wilson. Ben, appreciate you coming on, man. Thanks.
Let's go, Will. I've been waiting for this text for really since the start of your podcast. So it's a true honor to finally be here.
Well, I think you need to get some better hobbies, maybe some friends, some things to do. You have not that you have a lot of free time with all the games you're calling, but that let's get true. Into it. There's so much to do. College World Series, hockey, NBA. I guess we'll just start with both finals. Can you make a case for either Dallas or Edmonton to get back into these finals?
I can make a case more for Edmonton than I can for Dallas. If we're talking about actually winning the series here, because for Dallas, it's obvious to me on the just on their perspective of what you have to do to actually beat Boston with how solid they are all around in their offensive defensive game. And, so far, I mean, Dallas has not been willing to really make any adjustments. And even if they do, they're doing it with a Luka Doncic, who obviously is playing less than 100%, and a Kyrie Irving, who has basically regressed about the equivalent of 5 years in basically two games. It's wild to watch how great of a team player Irving had been throughout this entire playoff run, how smart he was with just the constant offensive decisions he was making in real time. Now, the defense hasn't gone anywhere. Irving's still playing, as hard as I can ever remember him playing on the defensive end. But I mean, it's obvious, Will. Like, he's so in his head right now, and he's forcing shots. He's letting the crowd get into it. I realize now you go back to Dallas, and sure, it's you're on your home court, and you feel a little bit better about that. But as someone who really expected this to be one of those Boston in 6, Boston in 7 type series, I wasn't ready to overreact after game one. But, when you think about the different paths of the series and the different individual game outcomes, right? We always assumed, okay, there'd be one game where Dallas probably just couldn't make any shots. And that, of course, happened in game one. You figured there'd be a game two, there would be one game here where Boston would really struggle to make their shots with how much of a high volume of threes they take. And that really happened in game two, and Dallas really couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't take advantage. It was still, a 3-point game at halftime when Boston played about as bad as humanly possible. I realize we still haven't had the Doncic just completely goes nuclear game, but, at this point, it kind of feels like you might get that for the one Dallas win. And outside of that, I just haven't seen enough. It just doesn't feel like Dallas is the rest of the contributing pieces are really at a level yet consistently based on all the bodies that and how good Boston's top, six really are when you include how solid Porzingis has been coming back from injury, where I just don't think it's realistic to believe that they can win four of the next six games. Whereas hockey is such a puck luck based sport to begin with. And, Edmonton, as much as I believe Florida is clearly the better team and has deserved to be the favorite this whole time and ought to win, it doesn't take much for a team as talented and fast as Edmonton. You take a couple of bad penalties if you're Florida, all of a sudden the ice opens up a little bit. That speed really gets exposed. Sergei Bobrovsky turns into a mortal, and all of a sudden, it's a tie series. So I would set the odds much, much greater on Edmonton, at least making this a series and having a legit chance to come back and win than I do Dallas right now.
If I just gave you a redo, say, hey, forget previous predictions. Who wins in how many games, both series, NBA and NHL finals?
I would say at this point, I would go Boston in five. I still imagine one of the two Dallas home games. You get the full Luka, and you probably get an Irving who it can't be any worse, right, from what we've seen in the first two games. And you get an Irving that is able to distribute a little bit more, that is, that kind of reverts to the Kyrie that we've watched throughout this playoffs. You get one, I'd say really, really good Dallas home performance, but Boston finds a way in one of those two road games, ekes out a close win, and up 3-1 going back home. They win it in five. I still believe Florida wins. I'm much more inclined, though, to think this goes, Florida. I would say Florida in six. I see Edmonton getting one, if not both, back home here. Florida, whether that's, I see it being a situation where Florida wins the cup on the road, and that's been a thing that's happened a bunch recently in these recent Stanley Cups here. Obviously last year was an exception there with Vegas winning on home ice, but I don't expect Edmonton is as ugly as it looked last night with all the guys getting ejected and the dirty hits and how they kind of just crumbled after the early goal that they scored on Sergei Bobrovsky. I do expect Edmonton to show a little bit of life here, much more so than Dallas. So I'll go Florida in six.
Yeah, I'm kind of caught between Boston sweep, Boston in five. I don't think Dallas gets both of these in Dallas. I think it's a coin flip between Boston winning one and Boston actually getting both of them and sweeping. And look, if Boston, if they get game three, you always worry about game four. Hey, if you're up 3-0, you might have just broken the opponent. Those game fours can be wonky when it's 3-0 anyway. So I don't know. Was hoping for a better series. Not sure we're going to get it. But you cover a lot of people haven't seen the draft is going to sneak up on us here with these finals dragging out. We're only a couple weeks away from the draft. You cover the G League. You've seen a lot of these guys. What are some of your draft thoughts here? I know not a lot of markets are up other than, hey, number one pick. We'll start to get more as we get closer, I would think. But just general takeaways, general thoughts here as the draft approaches.
Yeah, this is a fascinating year because a lot of the scouts, the execs, and having done play-by-play for the G League, you're so locked into that. I mean, I've been looking at mocks basically since last August. It's sort of part of the prep process where the G League Ignite, for those who don't know, that's the, that was the all select team basically of prospects that was sponsored, put up by the NBA. They just announced they were folding after this year. So that was obviously tough news for all of us who are covering the team and working for the team. But they have two potential number one prospects in Ron Holland and Modest Bezelis. And that's how the year started. So that's where I've been at, where I'm like, from day one, it's looking at mocks going back to August thinking, okay, how is this going to play out? And the consensus is you've probably heard many people say, okay, it's a weak draft. The thing I've heard kind of floated around is if this was, say, your status quo normal draft from a talent perspective, this draft would start around pick eight. Like that's how we kind of have to think about this mentally, where, the guys who are favored to go number one, like, Alex Saar, who I got to see in person. He played for the Perth Wildcats in the Australian NBL. He's in a normal year, you would probably think of him as a borderline top 10 guy. But because there's just not that great of a talent pool here, he is over a minus $2 favorite to go number one. But what people have to know, like this is the time of year where, the quote unquote, mock draft experts sort of come in. There's really only a few, mock guys that I really, really trust. There's Jonathan Gavoni from ESPN. Sam Vicini from The Athletic. Those guys are super locked and they watch a ton of Euro ball international leagues as well. So like they really know these guys well. I think a lot of these other mocks, like you have to be careful. A lot of these guys come in and it just becomes a consensus war, right? It's like, oh, okay, well, I see a couple of these guys mocking Saar at the top and this Rissachet guy who I've never watched film on from France. But yeah, he sounds pretty good. So I'm just going to put those guys 1-2 in the mocks, and that's just how it has to be. But when you have a wide open draft where there isn't any real consensus perception on who the actual total best player is, and usually what happens when you get toward the, you know, the end of the top 10, right? Well, it's teams start drafting more just for need, and they can be a little bit more specific. They don't have to, you know, they don't have to fall into that trap of like, all right, who's this franchise changing guy? Because it's not number one. It's, you know, it's number nine, it's number 10. That's where, like, I think the mentality is fascinating, because over the course of the last really 9 months, there have been, I think, four different guys, you know, in the mocks I've seen who have been viewed as a number one pick. Isaiah Collier, believe it or not, was the first number one guy from USC. That was back in back in September, before the USC season just went completely haywire and disastrous. He's like 100-1 now. He's not going to be, he's probably not going to go in the lottery. His stock has fallen so far. Ron Holland, who I covered, was also supposed to be, he was a consensus number one pick at one point. He had a really tough season. G League Ignite went 6-44. I call it all the home games. So I got to watch a lot of bad basketball. Well, it was tough. They struggled, and Holland got exposed for his, you know, he was a great, tenacious, all around player, but he really struggled with his jump shot. He had a lot of work to do on that. He got injured halfway through the year. They shut him down after about 25 games. So Holland is now, and I'm looking at DraftKings right now, he's like 20-1, but he's not going to go first till he's probably a borderline lottery guy. Still sounds like more late top 10. So that just kind of gives you the context of what has all happened here. Then it was, you know, Rissachet from France, who's around 2-1. Now it's Sarr from the Perth Wildcats, who's in the minus 200 range. Recently, and I'm talking last, 24, 48 hours, there's been a ton of Donovan Klingon UConn buzz. He was 18, 20-1 in some places. I mean, DraftKings just cut him down to 7-1. This, you know, this context all leads me into saying, well, it would not stun me whatsoever if by the time in a few weeks from now we get to draft night or draft week, and all of a sudden Klingon is like even money, or he's a minus money favorite. Like, it really shouldn't be viewed as, just because the numbers are where they are at now, there's no reason why a team like the groups at the top, like in Atlanta picking number one, couldn't talk themselves into a guy who's at least proven it, you know, on U.S. soil, and has won a national title. And you kind of know what you're getting in a, you know, a 7'3" guy who gives you length, who can step out. Whereas I think a lot of these other guys are just viewed as upside sort of projects long term. And so I totally get where now bettors, I think, are realizing this. And it wouldn't stun me if Klingon, you know, we're talking 7-1 right now, if that price, you know, shortens in half in a week, and if it's down to, you know, co-favorite or second favorite within a couple weeks.
What really complicates it too, aside from it being a super weak draft, is Atlanta's just a super weird team where they're not contending, they're not rebuilding, they're guard heavy with Young and Murray, but they could trade one of those guys, they could trade both of those guys, they could trade none of those guys, so they can really go in any direction. So that adds a layer too, where, you know, we don't really know what Atlanta's thinking. Are they going to try to compete next year and say, hey, we hit on this pick and we can be the 6th seed if things break right, the 5th seed, and we're in the mix? Or do they say, hey, we're a rebuilding team? I don't really know, and that complicates things. Let me ask this way. How many guys could go number one and you wouldn't be surprised? Like, could Castle go one? Like, what's that list look like?
Yeah, and I've seen the buzz too on him. He was, what, 100-1 a couple days ago? Now he's 30-1. And I think you're only going to see more buzz on those, you know, those UConn guys, just because there's so many unknowns in this draft. And it's, I think, very easy for us in a very, you know, in a very casual vacuum to look at it and go, well, look, these guys won national championships. They were part of great, great teams. We've all watched them. It's, you know, it's not to dismiss what the international guys have done, because I think NBA execs now, we've gotten into this era where it used to always be, okay, the foreign guys are just soft and all these lazy, you know, these lazy stereotypes we would assign for those guys. Now it's almost the reverse, where I feel like, you know, execs are, and I feel like it started with the Giannis draft, right? Where it was, okay, you're finding these guys, like these diamonds in the rough sort of players. Now there's so much more attention that is given to the, you know, the French league and, you know, the Euro league in general, the league in Australia, those sorts of teams. So yeah, I mean, Sarr, Rissachet, Klingon for sure. I mean, three at the very least wouldn't surprise me. you know, I would probably say of the, like, there's the Reed Sheppard piece, who's, you know, I don't, you know, he's really undersized, 6'1", but great shooter. Would, you know, Rob Dillingham, I was, it's funny, Rob Dillingham could kind of be like this draft's version of a Devin Booker, who didn't even, remember, Devin Booker didn't even start at Kentucky. Dillingham was this amazing player who John Calipari couldn't figure out how to get on the floor for some reason, but he's even been floated as a number one, you know, number one pick at times in some circles. So I would probably cap it at like 4, maybe 5. But yeah, that just kind of speaks to most drafts. It's usually 1 to 2 at most. And there's, you know, there's really not much after that. And that's what makes this thing so unique.
College World Series starts on Friday. What's the matchup you're most excited to see? And is there still like any value on these teams in terms of the futures?
Yeah, A&M Florida for me, which is the one of the first round games. And futures wise, you know, what I found last year, so having covered college baseball for a few years, and you know, I do my process is I'll see a lot of these teams like in late February, early March at these you know, these preseason tournaments. I usually do one in out in Arlington, Texas at the Ranger Stadium. And you know, back at that point, the odds are pretty soft, right? It's essentially books just put out whatever the top 25 preseason rankings are. They just order the team to like that. And there's really, it takes a while for those odds to really shift. It's changed a little bit now. There's more, I'd say, you know, more betting action in on college baseball over the last couple of years, but in general, you know, that's how it's always been. So I'll see these teams early in the year and I'm like, oh wow, like that team passes the eye test. They've got pitching. Their lineup is loaded and they're pretty long on the odds board relative to where they should be. And I'll, you know, fire on a couple of those teams and then just kind of sit back. What I found last year, you know, futures wise, why it's so hard is TCU was like the long shot that I hit on that got to the College World Series. But, you know, trying to like monetize and hedge out of those when it's double elimination, if you even start back in regionals, like you can have a team that has 4 or 5 elimination games. And so you could theoretically be like, all right, well, elimination game, time to hedge off, time to, you know, monetize this. Well, they win all those games, and like I almost got screwed last year with TCU because I got in, you know, way too deep on just assuming, oh, all right, this is a dream run. They're surely not gonna, you know, now it's over. And what happens? They win a couple games in the elimination bracket, and like you go through the elimination bracket in the College World Series, you're talking you got to win, you know, 3-4 games in a row. If you lose that first game, to now get to the, you know, the College World Series, the best 2 out of 3 championship series. So I would say off the bat, that's what makes it really tough. I would say for me, like the two futures I had given out, I think I was on A&G back in, you know, early March, Texas Tech, which was a terrible pick. They didn't even make the tournament. That they were like 50-1. But I gave out A&M at 18-1 and they're down to, you know, 3-4-1. I'm just so worried now that their best player got injured in the Super Regional, out for the year, Braden Montgomery, who's just a stud, came in from Stanford, outstanding transfer. And I'm just, you know, Texas A&M, they won, I think, their first 18 games, but they leaked a little bit of oil down the stretch. They kind of got by in supers just by, in regionals and supers just by mashing more so than anybody else. The pitching started to fall off a little bit. And the big thing we always talk about in Omaha is the pitching is usually what wins out. It's a huge ballpark. It's hard to just mash your way to these wins, and so that's why I worry a little bit about A&M, and so that's where I'm kind of trying to figure out, okay, how do I monetize that without going, you know, overboard, right? Because it's not as simple as just, oh, all right, bet Florida game one against them and just hope they win. Like, it's not as simple as that. So the A&M Florida piece is fascinating because Florida is the closest thing we have to that total sleeper that was always really good at the start of the year but struggled in the regular season, catches fire. And now they have as much talent as anybody, even though they basically went 500 in the regular season.
Yeah, and that's a good lesson. We've all been there. I think when you're betting these futures or long shots, unless you have a clean hedge or unless you really know what you're doing in terms of the math, you're better off just letting it ride because you could start, you know, putting yourself in a position where you're undoing all of your profit. You're undoing all of the good if you don't know what you're doing hedge wise.
I ended up having to bet like a way bigger bet than I wanted to, like on Florida in game last year against TCU in an elimination game. And it was like, I want to say it was like -280 or something, but it was like eighth inning. And I'm like, okay. And the second I make the bet, like TCU makes a rally and they get within one. And then they almost hit a, I think it would have been a go, either a game tying or go ahead homer that the guy missed by like 5 feet. And all of a sudden, I'm like, if that happens, you know, now I'm screwed. Like now, even if TCU wins the whole thing, like I'm basically just breaking even. Like it was just the worst situation you want to be when you've got a 40-1 ticket that it looks so good. So anyway, I feel like I've learned my lesson, but I feel like we also kind of have to go through that at least once as bettors to have that like, oh crap moment to really learn, you know, sometimes it takes learning the hard way for stuff like that. And I definitely did. So I've just been sitting on this A&M ticket. I'm like, all right, let's not go crazy. Let's not panic to, you know, the big injuries that they've had. But I still would be surprised, as good as they have been, with the losses that's happened, if they were able to actually make it through with how many, you know, amazing teams are in this final eight.
Yep. And the more you bet futures, at least my takeaway has always been, you know what? The more I learn about this, it's like I made the bet. I'm willing to lose the bet. It's a good number. I'd rather just do that. And just if you create so much anxiety trying to hedge out of these tickets sometimes when you got a big number.
You've learned over your esteemed career how to mitigate anxiety. So I'm trying to learn from you.
Yeah. Anything Major League Baseball wise that jumps out to you? Takeaways, futures, awards, anything you recommend at the moment?
Yeah, I've been watching the NL Central very closely all year. That division specifically, as a, you know, as a Wisconsinites, Brewers have always been my team, so to speak. But I'm fascinated by how that division, it's like nobody can get out of their own way. And Milwaukee is obviously going to regress. Like they can't keep up this pace when they're throwing out, Robert Gasser, some of these pitchers. Who's the other guy? Tobias Myers, who I'm like, how is he even on a major league roster? The pitching they're throwing out is just nothing. But they're the best base stealing team in the majors. They find ways to score runs. They've, even with no Devin Williams, they're still getting really good, really good bullpen usage and productivity as well. So I think from that end, like I'm looking at some of the, I think as the Brewers, like I expect them obviously to tail off a little bit, but I still see them winning this division. Like there's so many holes and issues on all the other teams. I think a way that it can be applied, like obviously you don't want to lay a big price right now on, Milwaukee to win the Central. It's, you're buying at the highest point in the market on them. But I do think a couple of their guys are totally live for NL Rookie of the Year, where the market right now is basically, it's the three, not really the four stud pitchers so far. Like Paul Skenes is not going to throw enough innings. Like he'll be shut down. He's not going to throw enough innings, I don't think, to be, taken seriously by the voters, like from a pure counting stats perspective as the Rookie of the Year. I just don't see it with how late he just got called up. And I think the same thing applies to Jared Jones, who I would argue has been better than Skenes so far. Skenes has been more electric, more exciting, but Jones has been there since day one and his stuff has been awesome. I just, it's impossible for me to really invest in that. And yet between the Yamamoto, between the Imanaga piece, you have, two guys where it's like, how much will they have to do as not true rookies, right? Having played overseas, and they both have, regression in their profiles with Imanaga. We've already seen that with a couple starts of him coming back to earth. So as much as, if you're looking for like long shot flyers and you've already been invested in that market, that's like the one where I do see, like, say like a Jackson Churio, who he was kind of in that Jackson Holiday range of super highly touted prospect, really, really high expectations, struggled out of the gate. But unlike Jackson Holiday, they didn't demote him, and he's, Churio homered last night. He's started to turn it around, and he's like 50-1. I mean, there's no, given his profile, there's no reason to think he couldn't somehow, he couldn't get hot. And as those top four pitchers, to me, will see either regression or innings caps. I easily see that market being a totally random guy who gets hot in the second half hitting wise. And so I'd kind of look way down the board. Like Joey Ortiz has had an outstanding year. And I think as long as Milwaukee's is in that first position in the NL Central, while I wouldn't want to, again, lay the big price on them to win it and invest that way, I do think you're going to see those rookies that have really propelled them to all the success get a lot more attention in the market in Rookie of the Year with the voting than you would normally, just because of the team's success there. So those are two that I would look at. It would be small, like pizza money bets, but I see them being totally live with the way the pitching, it's the odds are just so slanted toward those top pitchers that I just don't see the longevity being on.
Last one, any football bets get triggered by the schedule? Anything you're looking forward to? I know your Packers are going to be a hot team. The Texans are going to be everybody's darling, but anything football wise jump out to you?
Not yet. The only thing that really was triggered by the schedule was me looking at award flights to Sao Paulo for week one. And Yeah, there's no good no use of my hard-earned airline miles, Will. It's going to cost a pretty penny. So I don't think that trip is happening, unfortunately. But I will say I feel like that is going to be that the way that line was set. Like, don't remember the Packers were a what point and a half road dog last year all summer against Chicago, and everybody had him in a teaser on the road. It was like with how tight these teams are. I mean, I get this is a neutral site versus the Packers were in Chicago, but. That ended up flipping. Packers close favorites. They blow out the Bears. It's brutal for Philly that you have to give up a home game at the Link against a team like Green Bay to go to Sao Paulo, where there's probably going to be more Packer fans there anyway. So that seems like one that everyone's going to have in a teaser, getting the point and a half. And it wouldn't shock me if we get as the summer continues, you get interest there on Green Bay, and that line starts to move. So it's not a bet I've made yet because for Vegas, it's a little bit harder for us here with the limited amount of options at this point in the summer, but that's at least one I'm keeping my eye on. And if you see that start to move as we get close, that's one that I will be looking to fire on.
Ben, I appreciate you coming on, man. I hope as you get even more and more famous, you won't be hesitant to come on. You won't be too big to come on this podcast. It was a
Dude, come
pleasure to
on.
have you on.
I ne will never be too big. Come on, Will. You know that. I really appreciate the invite. Always great to see you, man. I know I'm sure we'll be hosting some shows too on VSiN over the summer because that's how it goes. Where everybody's on vacation, and that's my favorite time of year when I get to hang out with you for hours on end.
Ben, appreciate it, man. We'll do this again soon, hopefully.
Absolutely.
All right, before we go, as I was talking to Ben, we get breaking news that Kristaps Porzingis of the Celtics didn't re-aggravate his prior injury, but he did get hurt on that fall late in the game Sunday night. He's optimistic he will play. He thinks he can play, but we're not sure. Boston Mazzulla said, hey, we're going to have to clear him. We'll see. It's going to be out of his hands. So I'm not sure. I think it's maybe 60-40 that he doesn't play. And look, here, two things have to happen. Boston has to lose game three. Dallas has to win and make it 2-1, and then no Porzingis. And then maybe we're talking about, who knows, maybe a series. That's a lot of the rim protection, a lot of stretching the floor. Porzingis obviously matters. He was tremendous in game one. He was pretty good in game two. He matters. So we'll keep an eye on it. If Boston gets game three, with or without Porzingis, 3-0, you can figure it's over. But no Porzingis, that maybe slightly opens the door here and leaves the door slightly ajar for Dallas to get back in this series. Now I'm not so sure about game three. I was leaning towards Boston in game three. This would probably keep me off of it. So maybe a good live betting opportunity. See what's going on with Porzingis again. I'm not sure he plays here, and we'll see what the fallout is for that. But appreciate you guys listening. Thanks to Ben Wilson. That was fun to get some draft, talk about some other things. We will be back Friday. We'll see if we have a finals to discuss. If it's 3-0, there's not going to be much left to talk about. But if it's 2-1, who knows? Maybe we are looking at a longer finals after all. Rate, review, subscribe. See you Friday.